riveting right there. What the hell is this guy about? This is laughable. What the hell is that?
All righty then. Welcome to a special edition of The Sound Off, episode 129 here on SCScoops.com. I am the Solid Monster. It is Saturday, October 9th, 2010, and we have a very special treat for you later on in the show. My exclusive interview, a Sound Off exclusive with the Zombie. That's coming up a little bit later on. Of course, a ton of news to get to here, so we're going to get to that first, and then we'll have that interview for you later on in the podcast, so you'll definitely want to stay tuned for that. Also, just a quick note here, I want to thank everybody not only for downloading last week's show, but specifically the special edition that was episode 127, which is officially the most downloaded Sound Off to date, so I thank you for that. WWE Hell in a Cell pay-per-view last weekend. Just want to give some quick thoughts on that. I did not see the pay-per-view. I did not pay money for the pay-per-view. I do not regret doing that. By and large, based on your emails and other reviews and clips that I've seen, sounds like a pretty middle-of-the-road pay-per-view that was not exactly worth the $44.95 price tag, especially because of the main event, which has just been ripped a new one by people. Undertaker and Kane had a horrible match, and of course, the big payoff there was Paul Bearer turning on The Undertaker and aligning himself with his son Kane, who retained the World Heavyweight Championship over The Undertaker. Now, mind you, even with Paul Bearer's help, this was the second definitive pinfall victory over The Undertaker that Kane has had on pay-per-view. So, of course, these two men must be rematched yet again. We'll get to that in a second. Not a good main event. From the sounds of it, it would have probably made more sense to end the show with either the John Cena-Wade Barrett match, or if you wanted to end with a Cell match, end with the Randy Orton-Sheamus match, which resulted in Orton defeating Sheamus, retaining the championship, and would have sent the crowd home happy. So I guess they must have figured the Paul Bearer turn was something they wanted to save for the main event. I didn't expect them to do the Paul Bearer turn if they were going to do it this early. I wouldn't have done it 2 weeks after he made his comeback. But if you think about it from a storyline perspective, it makes perfect sense that Paul Bearer would want to seek a measure of revenge on the man that was responsible for burying him in a block of cement 6 years ago. You may recall it was The Undertaker who pulled the lever. That was the Great American Bash, one of the worst pay-per-views of all time. Great American Bash 04. So, Paul Bearer with Kane. It sounds as though the next pay-per-view bragging rights will feature a buried alive match between the two men, which I would have to imagine is going to be the blow-off of this feud. I guess we'll find out. Originally, I had heard that they were going to do this at Survivor Series, so they're moving things up a little bit by having the buried alive match in 2 weeks on pay-per-view. The other big news, of course, John Cena losing to Wade Barrett, as I predicted would happen last week, because it had to. You had to shake things up a little bit. It's an intriguing storyline. How will John Cena coexist with the members of the Nexus? Will he just fuck with them, or, you know, will he be subservient to the wishes of Wade Barrett? Now, we saw Raw Monday night that Cena had every intention of making a joke out of this, and then, of course, the anonymous GM chimes in to let Cena know that, in fact, if he does not listen to Wade Barrett and take orders from him, he will be fired. And this sent John Cena into almost a zombified state. He couldn't believe it. He said, WWE is his life. What else am I going to do without WWE? And on and on and on. So I'm happy they did that because it just makes things that much more interesting. So I'm perfectly fine with Wade Barrett beating John Cena. And the rest of the pay-per-view, really not much to talk about. It was kind of just there. And we move on. Bragging rights is already right around the corner. And if there was going to be another pay-per-view this year that would do even worse than Hell in a Cell will do, bragging rights is fucked. I mean, it's just too many pay-per-views in a short period of time, yes, but it's coming the night after a big, big UFC pay-per-view, 121, I believe it is, Brock Lesnar and Cain Velasquez, that's coming up. It's the Saturday night before bragging rights, that weekend, I believe, of the 23rd and 24th. And that alone is reason for WWE to be concerned because, you know, the belief is that that's, domestically anyway, that's why WrestleMania did so poorly this year. It's not the only reason, but a big reason is because it came the night after a big UFC pay-per-view. And they're going to do it again in November, I believe. So, anyway, any UFC show with Brock Lesnar on it is likely going to be threatening a million buys, and that is not good news for WWE. Plus, it's a big football game. There could potentially be a a World Series game for Major League Baseball. And WWE knows this. They know that this pay-per-view is just not going to do very well. But nonetheless, we have a Wade Barrett-Randy Orton championship match. John Cena will be in Wade Barrett's corner, stemming from the events of Raw this past Monday night. The Buried Alive match I mentioned will be another Team Raw versus Team SmackDown match, which nobody could possibly care about. I mean, they gave us no reason to care about the match last year. They gave the winning team a trophy that we knew nothing about in advance, and then the trophy pretty much disappeared off TV 3 weeks later. So they don't have anything on the line in this match. There's no draft picks. There's nothing. And the fact that they're doing a match like this, which I don't believe it's an elimination match, but nonetheless, to do a match like this weeks before your Survivor Series pay-per-view makes little sense to me. So we'll find out more about the teams in the next few weeks on Raw and on SmackDown. Speaking of Raw Monday Night, I actually thought it was a really good show, but there was one particular thing that just pissed me off. And it pissed a lot of you off, too, but it just pissed me off more. And I think you know what it was. And look, we know the WWE does not always do a very good job of putting over younger talent. I give them credit because they're trying. Because they realize guys like Chris Jericho, Triple H, The Undertaker are not going to be around forever. And in fact, Jericho is gone. Triple H may well be done as a full-time active wrestler. He's been gone for months. Undertaker is on his last legs. I mean, the poor bastard. He just looks like he can crumble into a mound of dust any day now. You know, they've lost Shawn Michaels this year. They've lost Batista. Like I said, they've lost Jericho now. They've got to make new stars. They're doing it with Alberto Del Rio on SmackDown, although they had Mysterio beat him clean on Friday night, so I don't know about that. And they're trying with the Nexus guys, and they're trying with Daniel Bryan. They put the U.S. title on Daniel Bryan. There's been times, like the pay-per-view, where he makes Miz, who's going to be a future world champion very soon. They make him tap out very easily and make Daniel Bryan look very strong. He's the United States champion and all that jazz. And I'm watching Raw Monday night, and they come back from a commercial break. And there's Daniel Bryan, your U.S. champion, just standing there. He's given no television introduction. He's just standing there like a jobber. And that was bad sign number one. Bad sign number two was when Sheamus comes walking down to the ring, because you could see this from a mile away. Now look, they have fed people to Sheamus before. They've fed Evan Bourne to him. Jamie Noble goes a ways back. And who cares about a Jamie Noble or an Evan Bourne in WWE's eyes? They're not going to push those guys beyond a certain point, so who cares? And if you want to sacrifice a guy like that, that's fine. Why they need to sacrifice not only a champion, but a man that they legitimately want to push. Vince McMahon likes Daniel Bryan. They want him to be a star. This is not them saying, you know what, fuck Daniel Bryan. We don't like him. We don't see anything in him, and so we're just going to push him as a jobber. You know what? If that was their rationale, I would disagree with them, but it would be understandable. But it's not. They legitimately want to push him and make him a star. And they think that this is not going to do damage. Now, look, if Sheamus and Daniel Bryan come out on Raw this week, coming up, and Daniel Bryan somehow gets his revenge, that's one thing. I don't think anybody is expecting that to happen, though. So they have Sheamus go out there and literally knee him in the back of the head into submission. It was actually a disqualification, so technically Daniel Bryan won the match. Whoop-de-doo. I mean, he just looked like a complete geek out there. And the fact is, it reminded me of Matt Hardy and Edge at SummerSlam in 2005. I mean, that was the big comeback match. They built that match up based on the real-life heat between the two of them. That was when, you know, Lita was involved in the whole storyline. And I remember that was one of the more talked-about matches of SummerSlam that year, besides Hogan and Michaels. And they go out there, and within 5 minutes, the referee just calls the match off. Matt Hardy is being beaten and punched and kicked by Edge so much and not defending himself, and he's busted open, and the referee just said, all right, he can take no more, and he called it off. And I just, couldn't help but think about that watching this on Monday night. I mean, Daniel Bryan got little, if any, offense in. He literally got pounded into the ground and left for dead. And I just don't understand why you need to sacrifice him. Was Tyson Kidd busy? You want a babyface in there? Put Tyson Kidd in there. What was he doing? What was R-Truth doing? It had to be Daniel Bryan. And they wonder why nobody ever gets over. It's just amazing the damage they do with shit like this. And they did the same thing on SmackDown, by the way, not this past Friday, but the week before, that first live SmackDown, when they took Cody Rhodes, who was one half of your unified, whatever the hell they want to call it, tag team champions, and he gets beaten like a nothing by Randy Orton. Why did you have to put Cody Rhodes in there again? And not only did he beat Cody Rhodes, he beat up Drew McIntyre too. If you want to have your champion look strong, your world champion, that's fine. If you want to have Sheamus, the story you're trying to get over is that Sheamus is pissed. He lost at Hell in a Cell and he's on a mission. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But why do you have to take a champion? Why do you have to take a guy that people kind of care about and are trying to get behind and make him look like a fucking nothing? So that pissed me off. That almost ruined Raw for me on Monday night. But it didn't. And I like the show overall. I like the storyline with Cena and Nexus. I'm still not sure why they didn't have Cena put a Nexus shirt on, other than they want John to keep wearing his shirts so the merchandise continues to sell. But he's got to start wearing the shirt, though, if he's going to be part of Nexus. Anyway, the big battle royal at the end. John Cena and Wade Barrett are the final two in there, and Cena reluctantly jumps over the top rope and eliminates himself. And as I said earlier, Wade Barrett will get a title match with Randy Orton at Bragging Rights. Edge has been traded to SmackDown, as we were told on Monday night, which is probably good for Edge because he just is a man with absolutely nothing to do these days. he has his little storyline where he's on a mission to eliminate all things stupid from WWE, which should keep him a pretty busy guy in the next couple of months. But he'll have some fresh faces to tangle with on SmackDown, and my hope is that, you know, when Christian is good and ready to come back from his pec surgery, hopefully Edge will still be on SmackDown, and maybe they'll do something, finally, with Edge and Christian. But the big question is, who will take Edge's spot on SmackDown? It was a trade, so obviously with one person going to Friday night, somebody has to move to Mondays, and that person would be CM Punk, which would, I guess in hindsight, it would kind of make sense then why he was sacrificed and made to look like an idiot against The Undertaker a couple of weeks ago. And The Undertaker, again, treated him like a jobber and beat him clean in the middle of the tombstone. I guess in a way, if they knew at that point that Punk was leaving the brand, it's almost tantamount to what they used to do in the old territory days, when if you knew that somebody was leaving, they would do the job on the way out. So that would make sense. And it's probably good for Punk, too. I mean, the Straight Edge Society is no more. He's a former world champion on three occasions and deserves better. He's still, now with Chris Jericho gone, Punk probably is the best talker in WWE. And I don't know who he feuds with, but I certainly would not mind a CM Punk Daniel Bryan U.S. title feud on Monday nights. Michael Cole, for those of you who have asked, is in fact going to permanently be part of the SmackDown announce crew. Now, this was a call that was made this past week. They took Cole off Superstars because the poor guy needs a break. So somebody else will call Superstars with Jerry Lawler every week. Cole will still be the head announcer on Raw, and he'll be part of a three-man booth on Friday nights with Matt Stryker and Todd Grisham. Now, the reason for this is Vince McMahon has been very down of late on Todd Grisham. Grisham has been the new whipping boy in the announce booth for Vince. In fact, there was a story in one of the newsletters this past week where Grisham recently got blown up on by Vince McMahon. He came through the curtain backstage, and Vince went on one of his classic rants on the announcers in front of everybody, just embarrassed the poor bastard, and basically told him, "You're not getting the job done." So they didn't remove him from the show. They're just adding Michael Cole because they don't feel Grisham can carry a show by himself. Look, I'm not a big fan of Grisham either. But the thing is, you know, the guy's in a position, he's in a no-win situation here. I mean, Grisham was the lead announcer with Jim Ross playing second fiddle before JR had his Bell's palsy attack. And that was not an easy position for him to be in. And now, you know, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's got Vince screaming in his head every week, and it can't be an easy job. So I feel bad for Todd Grisham, but quite frankly, I don't like him as an announcer. I don't think he is getting the job done. And if they want to put Michael Cole on there to add some flavor to it, well, by all means, go ahead and do that. Since I guess it'll play into his heel persona, I mean, they're going somewhere with it, so I'm entertained by the Michael Cole character. I don't think he's such a great play-by-play guy that he should be calling both Raw and SmackDown. I think that's a little ridiculous, but they don't have anybody else. I mean, that's the problem when you don't groom new announce talent and you don't want to use your best hand, which of course would be Jim Ross. You pretty much just have to live with what you got, and Michael Cole is pretty much all they have. So just wanted to mention the fact that that is supposed to be permanent. So we'll see if we'll see if it stays that way. I want to thank Corey, just really quick here. Corey, who's a big fan of the podcast, has become our unofficial NXT reporter now that NXT has moved off of Sci-Fi and onto WWE.com, which means there is a 0% chance I will ever watch this show again. He has kindly volunteered to watch, and or rather endure, NXT for all of us, and send in a report each week. Now, I don't really have the time to do an entire report this week. Hopefully I will next week. But Jamie, just for those of you who are morbidly curious about this, Jamie was the one who was eliminated. I believe she was the first NXT Season 3 elimination this past week. So she is gone, and Oksana and AJ and Naomi and Caitlin all live to fight another day. So thanks to Corey for the report. Keep sending them on in, and email them to me instead of Facebooking it to me. It just makes life a lot easier that way, and I'm less likely to forget about it if you email me. Let's talk some TNA here. TNA, of course, had their big Live Before the Glory Impact special on Thursday night, and I decided that I was going to sit down and enjoy the show, which I don't always have an opportunity or the desire, let's be honest, to do. I'm happy to report that I was able to endure 90 minutes of Impact before I tapped out and could take no more. What I saw of those 90 minutes was fucking putrid. It was a terrible show. It was a terrible show. I defy and I challenge any TNA fan listening to this podcast to email me and tell me that that show, overall, from top to bottom, was a good show on Thursday night. I defy anybody to do it. And if you do, you better have a damn good reason why. You can point to parts that you may have liked, but there is nobody on planet Earth who can honestly say, without lying through their teeth, that that was a good show on Thursday night. Mick Foley and Ric Flair, their match was the big featured match, the big match that was promoted throughout the week. And I will say this about that. They gave it their all. You know, Flair was Flair. Foley really tried hard. It just, to me, the whole thing came off as very, very sad. And even more so when Flair whipped out the bag of thumbtacks, because I just, you know, it's one thing if Ric Flair wants to kind of go with the flow and adapt to whoever his opponent is. And I remember when Ric Flair had his match with Big Show, when ECW became a brand on Sci-Fi and Big Show was the ECW champion. And Ric Flair was going to go hardcore for the first time. And he took a bump onto thumbtacks in that match, which I had never seen Ric Flair do that before. But he did it, and he did it to prove that he's a tough SOB. And you know what? It worked. Because Flair was coming to ECW, he was coming into that atmosphere, he was trying to prove a point, and he did that. And I didn't ever want to see him take a bump onto thumbtacks again. In this match, I just didn't see the purpose for it. You know, he brought them in himself. Why would he do that? I mean, we've seen, think about it in storyline perspective. I mean, we've seen people like Abyss and Mick Foley take so many bumps onto thumbtacks. Why would it even matter? It clearly has no effect on them. They obviously like it. Why even bring them into the match? So when I saw him bring that in, I just thought, this is very sad. And to see Ric Flair bleeding like a pig and rolling around in thumbtacks and his hair is all frayed, and it was just very depressing. And you know, the bump that Foley took off the stage was actually very impressive and very scary, because he overshot the table, and it looked as though he landed shoulder first onto the floor. I mean, I thought he broke his shoulder, and that was a cool-looking bump, but again, why is he doing that to himself? I mean, Foley is already at a point in his life where he can barely move. He has a lot of physical issues, and you know, it's one thing to wrestle every now and then and to still be active and you know, do that sort of thing, but I don't want to see him taking bumps like that anymore, because, you know, back in the day, that's what Cactus Jack did. That's what Mankind did. And he would take those bumps, and people would pop, and I would be right alongside them, cheering stuff like that. I mean, it made the character what he was. That's what he did. But to see him doing it now, all these years later, knowing that he doesn't have to do it anymore, he doesn't have to be wrestling at all, let alone falling on concrete like that, just, it doesn't serve any purpose. It wasn't even like it was a big pay-per-view match where you can maybe justify it. It was a throwaway television match. So anyway, it was pretty much what I expected. They had to rely on all the gimmicks, the barbed wire and the blood and the thumbtacks. And I give them credit because they tried very, very hard. They gave it their all. They did the best they could. That's all you can ask for. I just didn't think it was a great match or anything like that. I mean, and the ending was obviously a fuck finish because Flair basically, they were, again, it was a last man standing match. So the whole point is both men are down, the referee is counting, and the first person who can get to their feet before the count of 10, he'll win. And Flair basically stood up, and then he did the Flair flop down onto the thumbtacks, and the referee counted to 10, called the match off, and awarded the victory to Mick Foley. And I could tell you that that wasn't, not that Foley wasn't meant to win, but that that ending was not supposed to happen that way, where it looked pretty, it looked bad. It looked like somebody messed up. So anyway, I heard Flair cut an amazing drunken promo on Reaction later that night. I did not see Reaction, so I don't know how good it was. Hopefully I'll find it and check it out. So going back to the beginning of the show, though, the first half hour was all talk. Now, this is your big live show. You know, you're hoping to reel in some new viewers, which they did. Impact popped a 1.3, which is not a record for them, but it's a very good rating. And you spend the first 25 to 30 minutes of your show doing bullshit talking in the ring? Why? And it wasn't even good. I mean, they're talking about shit that I really just, it wasn't connecting with me. I couldn't understand why they were just standing around talking about meaningless bullshit and they and... You know, they showed footage of Hulk Hogan in the hospital, which was sad to watch, because Hulk... Look, if TNA is working us and Hulk is working us on Twitter and, you know, his back is legitimately fucked up. He's had a bunch of back surgeries. Maybe they're embellishing it. Maybe Hogan is going to be at the pay-per-view this weekend and he'll be part of the angle, which was the original plan was, you know, they would be Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, who would essentially turn heel and try to steal the company away from Dixie Carter. Now, my impression is Hulk is really hurt, and he will not be at the pay-per-view. He certainly will not be wrestling this Sunday. That's why they changed that particular match to a handicap match. If they knew Hogan was going to be there, you would have to expect they wouldn't take him off the show and tell people in promoting the pay-per-view that Hulk will not be there. So if Hulk shows up, to me, it's even more fucking stupid, because Hogan potentially, I mean, let's be honest, he's not going to make that much of a difference, I guess, but at this point. But you have Hulk Hogan available as potentially a draw for the pay-per-view, a hook for certain people, and you already went on TV and said he's not going to be there, so why would he be there? You know, Bischoff is in the ring with Sting and Nash, and then Joe and Jarrett come out, and Bischoff is just droning on and on about, are you happy now, and this and that, and I just could not possibly care. And we saw the thing later on in the show where... Actually, I didn't see it because I had already tapped out, but I guess Bischoff had a Dixie Carter sign a piece of paper that Dixie thought was what I presume was a release form for Abyss. I don't know, but I guess the story here is that she may have unwittingly signed control of the company or away to Eric Bischoff, and that's going to tie into the whole storyline. Here's the thing. Dixie Carter went on her Twitter many, 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 many times to hype this show and big changes and big surprises and big bullshit and all that stuff. And Dixie did a sit-down interview with Jeremy Borash. This was a couple of weeks ago. And they were talking about October 7th and the big live impact before the pay-per-view. And Dixie made a comment to the effect of, I think Borash, the question was, if there was something, if you had a bigger budget or an unlimited budget and there was one big change that you could make, what would it be? And Dixie's answer in so many words was, I would do what I'm going to do on October 7th. Only I would do it bigger if I had a bigger budget. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the fuck that was supposed to be. What exactly was that big change that Dixie Carter said we were going to see on October 7th? Maybe it was in the last half hour of the show that I missed. I don't know. I certainly didn't see anything. And you know, the other thing about this whole angle, I think what the reason I really could care less about what Bischoff was saying, to me, Eric Bischoff on TV for months now has been a heel. But he's not. He's supposed to be a babyface, at least until he turns heel this weekend. So all these things are all fucked up in that people who you think are heels are actually faces, and people you think are faces are actually heels. I mean, I've been thinking Samoa Joe is a babyface, and apparently I read somewhere that he's supposed to be a heel. Okay. These things are not made clear enough. And yes, I don't watch every episode of Impact. So maybe, you know, you can say, well, because you don't watch, that's why you don't know. Well, no. Just because I don't watch doesn't mean I don't know who the fucking babyfaces and heels are. For Christ's sake. I mean, I don't watch SmackDown every week either, but I know who the heels and who the faces are. So TNA has to straighten that shit out, because if people are confused, they're not going to care about these angles. So anyway, reaction from what I heard was really good. It usually is, but Impact sucked. So there you go. Bound for Glory is this weekend. That's their big pay-per-view, 10-10-10. And the rundown looks a little bit like this. We've got, of course, the three-way match for the TNA World Heavyweight title. Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, and Mr. Anderson. Kurt Angle has said that this is going to be the match of the year. He's got the whole thing mapped out. He can't wait to go over it with Hardy and Anderson. Kayfabe is dead. That probably will steal the show. Anytime Kurt Angle promises to have a match of the year, I worry for the guy, but more often than not, he's right. And he's had pretty good chemistry within the matches that he's had with Anderson and Hardy, even though I'm not as big of a fan anymore as I used to be on Ken Anderson. But should be a good match. I'm picking Kurt Angle in that one, since they're already advertising a Kurt Angle versus Rob Van Dam match for the Turning Point pay-per-view. So that might be a little bit of a spoiler there, but they've got advertisements out that say that. Monsters Ball, Rob Van Dam against the Monster Abyss. Abyss also promises to reveal who they are this weekend. Lethal Lockdown match, Fortune with Ric Flair against EV2 with Mick Foley. I don't know that Foley and Flair will actually be wrestling. I'm sure they'll get physical at some point. I know Foley has said that he even said on his Twitter, he's really, really, really hurting after that match on Thursday, which, again, it goes to my point earlier. He doesn't have to put his body through that. I don't want to see him do stuff like that anymore. You know, when he has to cancel a book signing because he's too hurt to fly, that's bad. That's just really, really bad. We've got the now handicap match, Kevin Nash, Sting, and the Pope against Jeff Jarrett and Samoa Joe. Speaking of Kevin Nash, he went on his Twitter yesterday. Everyone's going Twitter crazy. And basically said that he's done after the pay-per-view this Sunday. His contract with TNA is legit expiring on Monday. And, you know, some people still think he's positioning to get a better contract, and that's why he's saying it. He may well be, but the contract that he has is over as of Monday. He has no new contract, and he basically went online and said that he's done with TNA. He's not going to WWE. He's going to retire and spend more time with his family, and if that's what he wants to do, then I don't think anybody listening to this podcast right now is going to beg for a Kevin Nash return. I wish him nothing but the best. And, you know, I would, if I were a betting man, which I'm not, but if I was, I would say we have not seen the last of Kevin Nash. Doug Williams and Jay Lethal for the X Division title, the Motor City Machine Guns against Generation Me for the tag team titles. That should be a phenomenal match. Angelina Love against Velvet Sky against Madison Rain and Tara for the Knockouts title. Eric Young and Orlando Jordan against Ink Inc. And Team 3D will be there to make a major announcement. Oh, that's the other thing about Impact from Thursday. I almost forgot about this. Mickey James made her debut. And what a debut it was. They did this with Ric Flair, I think, when he debuted. Why they showed Mickey walking into the arena? I guess they did it as a tease before the commercial, but I would have just had her walk out there as a surprise later on instead of showing her beforehand, but what do I know? So yeah, Mickey James officially in TNA, one of the worst-kept secrets that she would eventually end up there. I still expect Carlito to end up there at some point, too. So Steve Austin did an interview this past week and teased the fact that he could very well see himself wrestling one more match. Now, this is surprising. Austin has said before that he feels he's got a couple of good matches left in his body. His neck is 100% after basically taking 7 years off from the ring. He's doing all of his own stunts and action movies and stuff like that. But he's never committed to making a return. And in fact, he's gone out of his way, including at the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago, to basically say it's not going to happen. So the fact now that he's saying, well, never say never, and this and that, tells me that we may very well see at least one more Steve Austin match. Perhaps perhaps WrestleMania 27 would be an appropriate time for that. And I could tell you that a Steve Austin versus heel John Cena, I think, if you really want to do big business, take a babyface Steve Austin, bring him back. John Cena, if he's a heel by that point, even if he's not a heel, believe me, the fans would turn him heel. That match has money written all over it. I did say once, I did a special edition of the Sound Off. We were doing, you know, fantasy feuds and whatnot, what I would like to see. And I believe I said that if Steve Austin were to ever make a comeback, the perfect opponent for him would be CM Punk. I think the two of them would work well together. And, you know, you've got Punk with his straight edge character against Austin, who was anything but straight edge back in the day. And, you know, I don't know if Austin could envision himself coming back for more than just one match. But if he did, I would not mind seeing an Austin-Punk feud either. So we'll see how serious he is about it. You know, he talked about Hulk Hogan in the interview, too. He never has anything good to say about Hogan. But, you know, even this time he was saying in this interview, he sometimes wishes he had a run with Hogan and they would have done really big business together. And I don't know, it just seemed a little odd that he would make these kind of comments if he didn't have another agenda here. So we'll see what happens with that. A couple of quick final notes here, and these news items come directly from the most recent edition. I wanted to comment on these three things from the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. A fine piece of wrestling journalism indeed. For WWE, it's interesting that in the newsletter he notes, the consensus on the creative side is that there has to be a shakeup, and I think anybody who watches wrestling in general, let alone WWE, will tell you that the product would benefit from a shakeup and changing things up a little bit. The consensus seems to be that something big is about to happen. It may have already been decided upon, but it's being kept secret, even from the creative team. Nobody knows exactly what is up Vince's sleeve. But the only thing that's being said is that come January, things are going to be very different in WWE. That could be good or bad. We'll see. I mean, what that could be, I don't know. Does that mean a John Cena heel turn? Well, I guess it could, but to me, if you're really going to shake the product up, it's going to take more than just one wrestler turning heel to really shake things up. So, an ominous piece of news indeed. One of the ideas talked about also in the newsletter this week and regarding WWE, which I chuckled at when I read it, was regarding pay-per-view buys being as awful as they are. Believe it or not, the company is considering going back to doing a live pregame show to push pay-per-view buys. What an idea! Obviously, I give a hearty thumbs up to that idea. I wonder where they could have heard that from. Now, but in all seriousness, they did these shows. You know, the free-for-all shows used to be a live pregame show back in the day, so I guess they're just thinking about bringing essentially the old free-for-all format back, which, you know, it doesn't exactly fit the idea that I talked about 2 weeks ago when I did my WWE review, and I talked about doing having almost like a little studio, a desk or something like that erected backstage and doing a live show like that. Whatever format it takes, I think it'll help a little bit at least. I mean, my idea, I think, is a little more involved and a little more realistic in terms of pushing the product to something serious. And you have interviews with wrestlers, you have people analyzing the matches. I don't know if that's the format they would go with, but obviously I'm a big proponent for pre- and post-game pay-per-view shows. So if they're considering it, I look at that as a good thing. And on the TNA front here, and this is just amazing. It's not surprising, but it's amazing. TNA did drug testing a couple weeks ago, and a bunch of wrestlers failed. So apparently TNA told the wrestlers that they failed, and so what happened? Nothing. There was no disciplinary action. There was no suspensions. There were no warnings. Nothing. So basically the message here is that people are going to continue to do exactly what they've been doing, and it really doesn't mean a damn thing. So to me, why waste money on drug testing? Throw away drug testing in TNA. If you're not going to do anything, what the fuck are you spending money on drug testing people for? So that's my message to TNA. TNA should just eliminate all drug testing. There should be drug testing for nothing at all. Let them take street drugs. Let them smoke pot. Let them take steroids. They can do whatever they want. It just doesn't make sense to spend money on drug testing if you're not going to punish people who fail. So I would eliminate drug testing in TNA. All right, so that was the big news of the week in WWE and TNA. I think that covers all the important stuff. We're going to skip the mailbag this week. We just don't have time for it. But keep sending in those questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I'll keep trying to answer as many of you directly as I can, and then we'll take the best questions and have a mailbag back up on the Sound Off next weekend. I also forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, I want to thank everybody who sent in birthday wishes to me and Dixie Carter. And by the way, I think we also share a birthday with Bruno Sammartino on October 6th. So anyway, thanks to everybody who Twittered and Facebooked and emailed and the couple of you that I saw. And thank you for all the birthday wishes. It was a good time. And I did, in fact, get the Chris Jericho DVD. Surprise, surprise. I have had absolutely no time to sit down and watch it. So it's still sitting there wrapped up in my in my room, but I will get to it very, very soon. And when I do, as I said, I'll have a little review of the documentary portion, at least, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. And I haven't watched Legendary yet either. That's a little lower on my priority list, but I'll get to that soon. Keep following me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Just had to get those quick plugs in there. So, without any further ado, let's get to the real meat and potatoes of the podcast this week. Really, really excited about this. Conducted an interview this week with, he's the undead, you might say. My interview with the zombie. It's a Sound Off exclusive. Enjoy.
All right, well, we have a special treat this week, a Sound Off exclusive. Now, as many of you know, because I mentioned it just last week, October is my favorite month. Not only because it's my birthday, but I love Halloween. You got ghouls, goblins, ghosts, all that good stuff. But in the spirit of the season, I've got something even better. How about zombies? I have a guest on the line who knows a thing or two about zombies. He played one on TV on the very first ECW on Sci-Fi, and he might just show up at your kid's birthday party if you ask him real nice. He also wrestles as the Arsonist, Tim Arson, and he's joining us right now. Tim, welcome to the Sound Off.
It's a pleasure to be on Solo Monster. It's very, 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 very exciting to be here. And also, as, of course, the zombie, the ECW zombie, Reigns, making the most of my 28 seconds of fame.
Come on. Years later, you are still as popular now as you were 4 years ago. Come on.
Now keep on riding that wave until it turns into a tsunami, which hopefully that means signing a WWE contract.
Well, let's hope so. You got a lot of support out there. Now, it's kind of funny that, you know, we have a zombie talking to a Solomonster right now. There truly is a first time for everything. It
is
Solomonster.
Quite a meeting. This is like Frost Nixon.
Well, I don't know if I go that far.
This is Oprah Tiger Woods. Did that happen?
I don't know. I was going to say Oprah and David Letterman, more like it.
Right, there you go.
Since I got you on, I got to ask you this question. As a safety aid for the people who are listening right now, what is the best way to kill a zombie? Is it always is aim for the head? Is that what it is?
Right through the brain, yeah.
Ah, okay. Wasn't sure if there were any other secret ways to kill a zombie, but there you go.
Brain, maybe if you spike his drink. Oh, but wait, zombies don't drink.
No, zombies don't drink. It'll come right out of the hole in his throat.
Yeah, exactly. So that's actually one of my gimmicks that I'm going to be using. A guy recommended it to me for a long time to use, like, the zombie survival kit at shows. That book. I don't know if you remember the book. There was a book called The Zombie Survival Kit.
No. Now, is it like a list of what, different things that you do to protect yourself from a zombie, or what is it about?
Yes, it's a handbook that describes, like you say, different things to protect yourself from a zombie, and, you know, should a zombie come out of nowhere, should you find out that a member of your family is a zombie, there's many different ways that, you know, you can combat a zombie, which I don't know if I want to be sharing those types of secrets with people out there in the world, but then again, they are wrestling fans, so
you got to keep kayfabe in some way.
Yeah.
Now, when we were talking this morning, you mentioned something that I was not aware of, yet both of us share in common. You originally wanted to be a broadcaster, and you would actually tape-record yourself while playing games of Madden, which I think is something interesting that a lot of people probably don't know about.
No, and it's something that I've always wanted to do, like we discussed this morning. I grew up listening to WFAN here in New York, which is a sports talk, 24-hour sports talk radio show, while other kids were listening probably to, you know, the Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears. I was coming up listening to sports radio. And like you said, I would tape record myself, my pathetic existence, I would tape record myself calling my Sega Genesis video Madden, at the time it was Madden 92 when Madden first came out, and I would be calling those games. I did Lakers versus Celtics, triple play baseball, you name it, I probably have called the game. And then I had a friend, in terms of wrestling, it goes way back to when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and they had the, I don't know how old you are, but I'm sure I'm older than you because I'm an old fart. They had the wrestling dolls, and I had the wrestling dolls, and my friend had wrestling dolls, and we had the whole collection of the WWF wrestling dolls back in the day, the Land of a Thousand Dances. Have you ever seen that video?
Oh, of course, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I think the dolls that you're referring to are probably the old LJN figures that they used to have.
LJN figures. Somebody's been doing that. How old are you, Jason?
It's
a place to ask a woman her age, but how old are you?
Let's just put it this way. I was old enough to have, let's see, I had the LJN, the Hasbros, and the wrestling buddies that they used to have.
Okay, that was later. But, yeah, so I would actually, we would put together shows. We would write on a yellow legal pad shows and cards, and we would broadcast the cards, and he would have one match and I would have one match, and we would be sitting there with our Royal Rumble WWF ring, which was also by LJN, and we would each take turns performing matches with the wrestling dolls, and you know, if there's anything more of an indication of, and nothing against homosexuals, but if there's anything more of an indication of something gayer at that age, tell me what it is. I don't know. But that was my fun. And that's what I loved to do growing up. And yes, we did. I did call it. I was, I think I was the brain, and my buddy was Gorilla Monsoon. So,
I don't know if you would agree, but to this day, in my opinion, Monsoon and Heenan still the best announced tandem in wrestling history.
Oh, by far. Ventura and McMahon did pretty good too, but still.
Absolutely.
But still, I mean, I don't know about you, but I put on those prime time wrestling shows every now and then to go to sleep. And not that it puts me to sleep, but it brings me back to that time. And when you go to sleep, you want to be in a comfort zone, and it just made me feel so comfortable just to watch Monsoon and Heenan going back and forth on that show. You know the show I'm talking about, right? Primetime Wrestling?
Oh, absolutely. Originally, it was a studio show, and then eventually it became more of a roundtable show.
Right. Well, I enjoyed the studio show when it was just Monsoon and Bobby and the Brain in the studio, and there would be like a wrestling doll set up. Whatever WWF LJN was pushing at that time, they would do it, and they would jaw-jack, they would go back and forth with each other, and then they would show jobber matches for the most part until we got maybe, you know, the Killer Bees versus the Hart Foundation joined in progress for Maple Leaf Gardens as
right,
the main
right.
event. And that was great because Hart Foundation was my favorite tag team growing up too. So I really enjoyed those times.
Yeah, it's days gone by, and it's kind of funny you bring that up because I don't know if you subscribe to the service, but they actually have episodes of Primetime now on their on-demand channel that they show each month, and a lot of great.
I've gotten pretty savvy with the computer, and I'm not going to say too much more than that. I've gotten pretty savvy with the computer, and I have an HDMI cable, and I work things out to my advantage so that I can take advantage of the content offered by WWE.
enough said. Now, we were talking about the broadcasting and all that. Obviously, your career path took a very different turn. Now, as you and I both share a mutual friend who happens to work for the World of Unpredictable Wrestling, which is a promotion here in New York.
It's a promotion.
Yes. It's in New York here, run by WWE Hall of Famer Johnny Rods. And you were, in fact, trained by Johnny, and you made your debut back in, I believe, 2001. Now, obviously, even just listening to you right now, people can tell you obviously grew up a wrestling fan. Was there any – I know you mentioned the Hart Foundation was your favorite tag team, but was there any particular singles wrestler or personality that was a big influence on your career coming up? And also tell us a little bit about how your training came about with Johnny.
All right. My influences that make the character known as Tim Arson were one, Don Morocco, Magnificent One, one Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff. I also, if you're talking about the zombie character, that is a combination of George the Animal Steel and the Missing Link, Dewey Robertson. But in terms of just as Tim Arson, again, the Magnificent Don Morocco, Paul Orndorff, and I'd say Terry Funk at that time as well. They were definitely my favorites coming up. Obviously, growing up here in New York, all we had was WWF and PWI magazine to see what was going on down south before they started showing on. They started showing. I think they, you know, when cable came in, I was about 9 years. I was about 12 years old when cable came to New York, and I was able to see TBS and finally see the NWA. So I really didn't take to that as much as WWF. WWF was always number one to me, as was for many people. But yeah, I'd say Orndorff, Morocco, and Terry Funk, just to name a few.
All very big influences, I think, on a lot of people, those guys were. Now, I just wanted to ask you something here. I don't know if this is true or not. I have read that you had done a Canadian sympathizer gimmick early on in your career. Now, is there any truth to that?
Yes, there is. And that was the other wrestling influence that I was going to mention. A man by the name of Len Milano, who was... Prior to 2001 and 2000, I worked at the ESPN Sports Ticker, which is over in Jersey City. Long story short, it was a part-time job. Awesome. One of my favorite jobs of all time, because it was ESPN Sports Ticker, and I would take calls from the reporters at the games and then type in the system with the score, the quarter, and the time left and that was left. And there was a huge wrestling fan that was my boss there. I still talk to him to this day, and he was really old school. I mean, he went back even before me, he's got me by 15 years. So he helped me with that, with the Canadian sympathizer gimmick, and he used to actually put my promos together for me and help me, like you say, develop that type of character of the guy that trains tirelessly and left New York to go up there to get the type of training that he needed to run through the forest bare-chested and wrestle a Canadian Wolverine to the ground and snap its neck to do pull-ups. Wide pull-ups on a Canadian maple tree over a frosty river, to go swimming in a Canadian stream and catch trout barehanded to improve hand-eye coordination. These are the things that made the arsonist Tim Arson, the Canadian sympathizer.
Now, you began touring Puerto Rico a couple of years after you made your debut. You actually have had quite a bit of success down there. I know you won the world title for the NWS promotion. You've won the tag team titles in Carlos Colon's World Wrestling Council. How did you enjoy, I guess, how did you enjoy your experience working in Puerto Rico, and how would you compare it to wrestling in the Northeast?
There's no comparison. Working in Puerto Rico was my education for professional wrestling. Was getting trained by Johnny Rods at Gleason's for there, that was to teach the fundamentals of the game. You know, how to do roles, how to do your basics. The psychology end of the business and how to cut promos were all obtained in Puerto Rico. And the main thing, any advice that I could give to any guys out there, any young guys out there, is to take what you can from the place that you're at and move on, because the clock's always running and time runs out so fast in this business nowadays. The business is changing overnight. Things aren't like they used to be, obviously. But if there's any advice that I can give, if anybody wants to follow in the way that I did things or similar or likes me, then I would say to take what you can from a particular place. I'm just going to tell you the truth. I stayed at Gleason's for too long. I stayed there for over 10 years. And I think Johnny was kind of trying to tell me that, but in other words, and that's why, I don't know that, not that, like, you know, we still like each other, but he was telling me that I was ready without telling me that I was ready to move on, which means that, like, the way that Matt Stryker did it was perfect. Matt came in, he learned the basic fundamentals of Gleason's. Matt isn't the greatest wrestler in the world. Matt sucks in the ring, and Matt will tell you that. There's no problem with that. But Matt and I once said to each other that we will work together in WWE one day. And Matt left. Matt left after about 2 years at Gleason's, and he started doing shows. He got his name out there, and he started learning how to work. And, you know, maybe if I had done it like that, maybe I would have been given the props to Puerto Rico like I do give, because I really did learn everything that I know about wrestling in Puerto Rico, because Johnny is just so limited, and I couldn't learn half the I couldn't get to that next level if I would have just stayed at Gleason's. And in Puerto Rico, you're working 3 days a week, you're cutting promos. Every Tuesday at the office, you're cutting three promos for that weekend shows, and you're learning by doing how to succeed in the business. And it's the wear and tear on the body, because it's the same as a WWE schedule. I mean, it started out 4 days a week, but then business started to slow down there, so then it went to 3 days a week. But you're basically doing everything that you would be doing in WWE. You're cutting promos on one day, which is what they used to do back in the day when they worked in Poughkeepsie and Allentown. And then you have the weekend where you're going to be performing. And in performing, there's psychology in the matches. I had the great fortune to be surrounded at every step of the game by great people. I just levitated toward great people, people that knew their shit, knew what they were talking about. When I started at Gleason's, Johnny was there. And a lot of people laugh at Johnny. A lot of people laugh at Johnny because he stays in the office. He doesn't come out and get in the ring with people. Those people miss the boat and have no clue what this business is all about. They have no clue that you don't need Johnny to get in the ring and show you what to do. Johnny's words were enough to teach me, and I'm very hard-headed. It took me a long time to realize it, but to get out there and to learn on my own. My tag team partner in WWC in Puerto Rico was Rico Suave. He was there for 25 years. Rico Suave is the son of Jose Estrada, who was the partner of Johnny Rods when they were the Super Medicos for years, for over 20, I think 15 years they were together as tag team partners. And they still, to this day, still calls him my compi, which in Spanish means partner. And I got to be Rico Suave's partner, and they put us together. And Jose Estrada, Johnny's partner, was our manager. So Rico taught me how the art of tag team wrestling, and basically the art of singles wrestling, too, because I watched him do singles matches, and then he critiqued my singles matches, and there's no better way of getting an education in wrestling than in Puerto Rico, and that's why it burns my balls that their business is down right now, and that they were calling Puerto Rico the last great territory, and I think that I may have been one of the last gringos who had the opportunity to go down there and get the type of education that you need to make it to the next level. And for that, I am completely thankful for. And a lot of people don't understand that here in the Northeast, especially with the way the business is today, because it just, as you can see on TV, these Nexus guys, they're working on top. And these guys, I know I have much more training than they do, but they were in the right place at the right time, and that's just the direction that the company is choosing to go nowadays. I'm sorry for going on for so long.
No, that's quite all right. As a matter of fact, I don't want to belabor the point because I know we have limited time here, but I'm happy you brought that point up about working in Puerto Rico, because I made a comment on, I think it was on the last show that I did, talking about WWE and such, and it seems as though, and I'm curious to see if you agree with this, it seems as though people who come to WWE, I think more so than TNA, who have worked in different places, whether it's Puerto Rico, Mexico, Japan, Europe, you would think it's a good thing to learn different styles, and it almost seems as though it's frowned upon because they want you to conform to a certain style, whereas I think, and I'm curious to get your feedback on this, I think it's a good thing to be trained in a lot of different styles because it makes you stand out more.
Absolutely, and it is a good thing, and it always has been a good thing, and I wouldn't be in the game, I wouldn't get into wrestling if I was going someplace to conform, to be a robot, to not even have my own brain in thinking of promos. I mean, this is the place where I learned how to cut promos. I know how to get people excited to want to come out and either cheer for me or to even want to come out and hate me and boo the shit out of me and throw things at me and throw piss at me and throw batteries at me and miss my head by a quarter inch with hitting me with a thick, solid 6-inch pipe. I swear to God, it was a baseball stadium one night, and I was walking back to the locker room. It was a Friday night. I was thinking about the stop at the gas station that the boys are making, and we're grabbing 30 beers for the 2-hour ride back up the coast. I mean, Puerto Rico is the best, man. It was the best, and that's where you learned how to cut promos and how to work. And it's just so disheartening to me, even though I'm still a fan of WWE and we still do watch and try to see the good in it and to see the direction that they're going in. But Vince always killed what he didn't create. I mean, we know that's for sure. But now it seems like guys that have been on top for a long time are being phased out. Like you're seeing that with Jericho. I'm starting to see it with Edge. I'm seeing it with Christian. And these guys all have their chin up. They want to put over the younger talent. But I think even in their mind, I think everybody's so mind fucked by what's going on right now, because they've worked so hard to get to where they are that they feel like, yes, I'm getting, now I think a lot of guys that are in that stage of the game, in their late 30s, like an Edge or a Christian or a Chris Jericho, guys like that now where it would feel good to pass the torch, like the last person that we saw do that was Shawn to Ric Flair, was Ric Flair to Shawn at the retirement match at Mania. And there just isn't that. It just isn't that anymore. It just isn't that anymore. Guys are not passing the torch. Guys are just giving up, it looks like. And it looks like the guys, because the company doesn't know what direction they're going in. And it looks like they're going with youth. But it's just that they just have every promo written out word for word down to the letter, and I don't know. I'm just very, very disheartened with what's going on right now. And guys are just not happy about it. And you can tell. You can tell in the way that they deliver their lines. Like, you know, Big Show and these guys that have been around for over 10 years. It's just hard. It's hard to get into it. But, sir.
Now, I was going to get your thoughts on the current product later on, but since we're on the subject, I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, now, obviously you follow WWE closely. You're still a big wrestling fan. And I know you've got some. I know you've got some strong opinions.
TNA and AAA. I follow all of them.
Okay. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, it seems to me that there's an endless pool these days of third generation talent, and even in some cases fourth generation talent that are being flooded on TV. You've got this new diva season of NXT, which in my opinion is an absolute joke. Do you think these things actually help or hurt the business?
Well, it's funny you say that because I think it's one of the best NXTs that there is so far. It's got the Jersey Shore factor in there, like where they're not really doing anything, but you can't change the channel.
Right. Well, hey, as far as an absolute train wreck, it's the best thing going on. Well, I guess it's going on online right now. It's not on TV anymore. But I guess what I mean by that is when
took it off TV. The point, they did.
Well, yeah, it's off Sci-Fi now, starting this week. Yeah, it's on the it's on WWE.com as of this week. They did not get a new TV deal.
Wow, I didn't even know that. Wow, that sucks.
But I guess the point that I was trying to make, I guess, was when NXT was initially conceived, I guess the idea was they wanted to get young talent over, and I think they've done a good job of that with the first season NXT guys to some degree, but when you've got these women out there and you have Michael Cole on commentary basically making a mockery, entertaining as he may be, he's making a mockery of the show. In my opinion, I think you're going against what the original idea of the entire show was. You're putting down talent that you're supposed to be getting over.
I couldn't agree more. Michael Cole, he's obviously transforming into a new heel type of character. I've laughed at a couple of things that he's done, but you're absolutely right. He puts down talent completely, and if you're gonna, my wife and I are huge wrestling fans. She's been a huge wrestling fan since she was young in Puerto Rico. I met her in Puerto Rico while I was there, and we both find ourselves scratching our heads a lot of times on why they do the things that they do. She hates the new, and she's a big women's wrestling fan, and she hates the new NXT just like you do. Maybe I'm just, like I said, I'm just retarded, and I can't turn it off.
I want to backtrack just a little bit here because I know people are going to want to know about the zombie and the origins of the zombie. So I figure let's backtrack a little bit here. Now, it was the first episode of ECW on Sci-Fi. So this was June 13, 2006. And I bring up the date because a lot of people probably don't remember that you actually competed the night before as yourself in a match that was taped for Sunday Night Heat against Matt Stryker, who you mentioned earlier. Matt was also trained by Johnny Rods. Now, do you and Matt still keep in touch? Are you two still friends at all?
That's funny you should say that. Yeah, I mean, I still text him from time to time. I haven't really spoken to him since I was there in 2006, over, 5 years ago now, pretty much, 4 years ago.
What are your thoughts on his commentary skills?
Well, I think he's great. I think he's hilarious. I think he's really funny at times, but I think sometimes he goes overboard and they get mad at him. But the main thing is that Vince loves him, so.
Sure.
And anybody can get mad at him, but as long as Vince loves him, he's untouchable. But no, I love Matt, and I wish nothing but the best for him, and I'm so happy for him to be where he is, because we did say, like I said, he said in that ring, it was a Saturday morning. He started like 2 weeks before I did. And we said one Saturday morning we were both the most athletic in Gleason's at that time, and we thought that it was about athletics, believe it or not. And he said that, you know, one day we're going to be, we're going to make it together, and we're going to be in the WWE ring together. And sure as shit, the day before I did the zombie on June 12th, we were in the ring and we worked together. And I'll never forget, his advice was, you can have a job in this company. You can have a job in this company. You just got to polish up on this, this, and that. And I'm still not employed by the company. but I still have hopes of getting there someday.
Sure. So you had your match with Stryker. Now the next night, of course, it's the big ECW debut, and the company was coming off a pay-per-view, the One Night Stand show. There's a great deal of momentum.
Crazy.
And excitement.
It is.
Well, I was going to say that there was also some degree of trepidation because, as the story goes, Sci-Fi Network wanted WWE to incorporate some science fiction elements into the program. Now, I've heard you kind of tell the story before, but I want you to tell it again for those who haven't heard it, because it's a great one. Explain how it came to pass that you ended up working the show that night against Sandman as the zombie and the role that Paul Heyman played in making that happen.
Okay. Well, it was really the role that Tommy Dreamer played in making that happen. Tommy Dreamer was the road agent at that time. He was the main guy. And so he called me in to come to the tryout on that Monday where I wrestled Stryker. Called me for the date with Stryker, like I said. And he knew me that I was from Johnny's. Tommy also started at Johnny's way back when, along with Taz and Devon. So it felt like I was a part of a little bit of a family there, and there was a little bit of a brotherly lookout. And in any case, that wasn't the case. But so on the Tuesday, I show up at SmackDown, and as is customary, there's catering at 12 o'clock, and we had catering, and then the guys get to go down and work out in the ring, the guys that showed up for the tryouts. So there's about like 15, 20 other guys that showed up that day. A lot of guys, I think, when they're on the East Coast, they just show up, and they weren't invited, but nonetheless, they still get to work out, and so everybody worked out pretty much for the whole day, up until like 5:30, around 6 o'clock. Now, don't forget that they're taping the first episode of ECW on a SmackDown taping. So that would be first at 7 o'clock, and then they would have SmackDown taping starting at 8 o'clock. So the SmackDown taping started at 8 o'clock. So everybody else got dressed, went back to get dressed, and then just pretty much got ready to go out and watch the show. And then they hung around backstage. I was still in my workout gear, and I was looking around, and I knew the thing with ECW was starting, and I wanted to do something. I was slated to go back to Puerto Rico the next day, and I didn't want to just get changed. I wanted to be a part of this. It was the first episode of ECW on Sci-Fi, and so many of my heroes, Shane Douglas, just incredible. I mean, a lot of people in my life, those guys now, but I tell you, at a time, man, they were my idols. My ECW was my rejuvenation in wrestling. When my brother introduced me to ECW when it was on public access here in New York back in, I guess, 97, 98, something like that. But in any case, so I wanted to be on there. I wanted to be with these guys. And I had no idea how it was going to end up. And obviously, we saw what happened with ECW. But the fact is, I knew Paul Heyman was there. Tommy was there. Devon, was Devon there at the time?
Yes, I believe he was.
Devon was there. Vito was there. Vito, another Johnny alum, Scoban Crush. At the time, he was doing the Vito dress gimmick at SmackDown, which may have been a punishment. So, long story short, I'm in my workout. It's already a long story. I'm in my workout gear, and I go to Vito. I go, hey, bro. And he's always been like a big brother to me, whether I like it or not. He helped me out in Puerto Rico, and and he helped me out all along the way. He helped me out at Gleason's. He would come and work out there, tell me what I was doing wrong. Most of the time, abused me. But anyway, I said, bro, what should I do? I don't know what to do. These other guys got changed. It looks like it was 6:30 at that time. They were 45 minutes from showtime. 7:15 they were starting. What should I do? Should I go get changed? Should I be like these other guys? He's like, no, you keep your mouth fucking shut. You see this crate right here? You sit right there. And this is right in the back, about 100 feet behind the curtain, but in the main walkway where everybody's walking back and forth from catering to the offices to everything. So you're fully noticeable. They had a Martian that they were going to use, and apparently he disappeared. So Tommy Dreamer and Paul Heyman were about 50 feet from me, and I heard Paul going, where's the Martian? Where's the Martian? And Tommy's like, I don't know. And then Paul was like, I don't know about a Martian. He's like, I don't know. He's like, this is ECW. It's, I don't know about a Martian. We need a zombie. Who the fuck can we get to play a zombie, though? Tommy Dreamer out of the corner of his eye, he saw me. And I guess I saved the day for him because he was like, Tim Martian? I don't think that he didn't have any intention of using me at all. But I was there. I took Vito's advice. I sat there in my workout gear, and he said, Tim Martian? And I was like, yes, yes. And I ran over, and Paul Heyman was like, show me your best zombie, kid. And I went, Bleh. He's like, what the fuck is that? He's like, zombies like brains. He's like, scream out brains. And so then I did the brains. And he's like, all right. He's like, you got it. He's like, you got it. And then he goes to Tommy. He goes, is this guy good? And Tommy goes, he was trained by John. He's like, get in the chair for makeup. And as God is my witness, they took my jeans that I wore to the show because they didn't have any jeans there, and they needed jeans. And they ripped my jeans up. They cut them up. They went outside. They got real cups of dirt from outside of the Sovereign Center, Sovereign Bank Arena, at the time in Trenton, New Jersey. They came in. They had a lumberjack shirt for me. They filled up the pockets with this real live dirt, and they sent somebody out to Gap to buy me another pair of jeans. And then Fit Finley came. He was the road agent for the match. I was working Sandman, who me and Hacker are really good friends because of Puerto Rico again. Because the previous summer, it was right before he got signed, he was down in Puerto Rico, and he was working for Carlos for 2 weeks. And he was in the best shape of his life. And anyway, we hit it off because we were both Northeast boys, and we hung out. I've never drinking so much in my life. My God, That's for another show. He kept me out till 9:30 in the morning one day. Yeah, that's right, 9:30 in the morning. We started at 5 at night the night before, out till 9:30 in the morning the next day. So anyway, so Sandman comes over. He's like, all right, kid, I'm just going to come in. We're just going to do this, and that. And that was fine. Then Fit Finley came over. He got me. He's like, all right, now it's time for final approval. And so I had to follow him, and he took me to Vince. And Vince was on the phone with two beautiful women in a little side office, and he goes, Vince, this is the zombie. He goes, go ahead, kid, show him the zombie. And I went, brains! And he goes, that's fucking brilliant.
Awesome.
And then he went right back to his phone call, and he was like, oh, great. So if he thought it was brilliant or not, I don't know. But anyway, Paul London and Spanky Pop were huge. And a couple of other guys did too. And then, finally, I mean, it was showtime, and I went out and did my thing. And ever since, I mean, it's just been a fucking, an unbelievable wave of popularity and people that have wanted to book me.
Well,
as a zombie.
It sounds like it was truly right place, right time for you.
It was right place, right time. And I also, at times on shows, I'll say, you know, as my lead-in for the ring announcer, the last great creation of Paul Heyman. Because really it was. It was the last great creation because he wasn't around for too much longer after that.
Right.
And
right.
Nothing against Kevin Thorne, but he's had more chances than a little bit.
I think you could say that about a lot of guys that don't necessarily deserve.
Exactly. But honestly, like, some guys are really bitter. Like, who was it? I forgot who I heard. But you hear guys all the time that are bitter about it. But, you know, how can I be bitter about it? I got to do what I wanted to do as a little kid. I got to wrestle in a WWE ring. And even if I don't ever get signed, I still got to wrestle in the WWE ring. I got to live my dream. I went to Puerto Rico, and I wrestled professionally in Puerto Rico. And let me tell you something. I was a celebrity down there. I was a top dog down there because I was on the main channel, and I was a tag team champion, and I was a world champion at the same time. I'm the first wrestler in Puerto Rico wrestling history that held not only a major tag team title for one promotion, but a heavyweight title for another promotion at the same time.
Not too many people can claim that.
Never in the history of Puerto Rico wrestling nobody can claim it. Nobody can claim it. Nobody has ever held two major titles in two different major promotions at the same time in Puerto Rico, ever in the history of Puerto Rico wrestling. And like I said, I was a celebrity down there. I met my wife down there, and, you know, I mean, it's not the happily ever after. I'm still working. I'm still busting my ass, but hopefully there's a part two to the story, and we'll just keep on moving on from there.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on and doing this. I wish we had more time. I had more questions, but it's counting
me down. Sure, I'm so sorry.
But,
I know I rambled on a lot. Hopefully you could edit it down a bit.
Believe me, it's quite all right. I just wanted to give you a chance here with the 60 seconds we got left. If there's anything you wanted to plug, I know you got your Facebook. You're taking zombie bookings, so let her rip. Tell people what they need to know.
Okay. It is ecwzombie06@gmail.com. That's for booking the zombie. Also, Tim Arson, 2004@yahoo.com. Facebook.com/official Tim Arson. And on Twitter, it's @TimArson. And trying to think of anything else. This Saturday, October 9th, we'll be in the ECW Zombie. We'll be in Center Reach, Long Island for Victory Pro Wrestling. And on October 23rd, I'll be up in Denver, Pennsylvania for ACW for my friend Tate, Twisted Tate. And that's going to be exciting, too. I haven't been up there in about 3 years.
Awesome.
And one last thing. I am on special delivery on the virus on Sirius 192, XM 202, Saturday nights 9 to 12. And that's pretty much heard all over the world. And also one other thing, I'm going to be Thursday, October 14th, I'm going to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Believe it
really?
Or not. Yeah, yeah. I got
sorry,
tickets.
We didn't have more time to talk about that. That sounds interesting.
Well, you know what? Leave a little bit for the next time. You don't want to give it all away in one shot.
Absolutely. Well, Tim, listen, thank you so much. I appreciate you doing this, and hopefully we'll be able to get you back on down the road to talk more wrestling.
Finally, we did it, Jason.
I know. It only took 2 months to get the done. But you know what? It worked out better because it's October. It's the month of the zombie. It worked out better that way.
Month of the zombie. Brains. Too bad you weren't near me. I'd eat your brains right now, Jason.
Oh, believe me. I'm safe. Well, you're not that far away from me. I'm in Brooklyn. You're in Staten Island. So
Maybe tickle your balls with a feather.
Oh my God! You know what? It's after midnight. It's getting a little weird. You know, by the way, I just have to mention this here. I did notice on your Facebook page you have Zombieland listed as your favorite movie, which I popped for huge when I saw that. So.
Zombies. That movie was one of many great zombie movies, but I really enjoyed that one. That was one of the better ones. Is that my favorite movie?
I think it's the only one listed.
Oh, it is? Okay. My favorite is the 28 Days Later series. I'm a fan zombie. I chase the ref around. I chase everybody around.
Tim, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Jason. Anytime. Anytime, brother.
All right.
Anytime.
Thanks to everybody else. Thanks to everybody for listening. As always, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week for episode 130 of Sound Off on SEScoops.com.
God bless America. Happy Halloween. Brains!
Let me tell you something, fast.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.